So now I invite Assistant Secretary Biswal to the podium.
Thanks very much, Michael. And thank all of you for your forbearance. I know that when we planned this important discussion many months ago, we certainly had no idea about the very important events that we would be working on this week with respect to the President's trip to India, with respect to last week Secretary Kerry's trip to the Vibrant Gujarat Summit. But we also did not know that we would be in the midst of this massive protest on Capitol Hill. So I apologize that as I departed the Capitol, I was encompassed in a mass of about, 10,000 protesters exercising their very vibrant democratic rights in our democratic society, but which created a little bit of a logistical impediment for me in getting here. But get here I did. And I'm so glad that I was able to make it, because it is indeed an honor to be here at the Wilson Center, an institution with which I have had long association, but which has had a very special place in our society in advancing the thoughtful and important discourse on American foreign policy. Really important leadership in the form of both Lee Hamilton and currently with Jane Harman, both of whom came from the House of Representatives, and both of whom for whom I certainly have deep respect and admiration from having worked with them. And really appreciate the role that the Wilson Center staff has always played as well in focusing attention on critical and important issues. It's also just a real honor for me to come here and to be able to speak in a room full of people who care deeply about the region and with a panel that is so renowned and expert in and of itself. And I know you need no introduction to Dr. Fred Starr and the important contributions that he has made over the decades on U.S. policy towards Central Asia. Mara Burr, my colleague from the administration, who's no longer in the administration, but who has really done yeoman's work in advancing our economic and trade partnership with the region. And, of course, Jan Kalicki, who himself has decades of work on energy and security issues. And so, really, it's a real honor to be here and to be part of this this conversation and this discussion. And it's great to see so many friends out here in the room, and particularly really honored that Ambassador Umarov, that you took time out of your very busy schedule. I know that these conversations around regional integration and the New Silk Road are ones that we have worked on and collaborated on together these many months and years, and certainly your leadership and the leadership of your minister and of your president has been incredibly important to advancing these issues. This is a real opportunity, and I wanted to be able to take a few minutes with you, and I did have a few slides which I hope will help to illustrate some of what we see as both the challenges and the opportunities as we move forward. I promise you it's not a DOD slide presentation. We've really kept it very, very light. But it's an opportunity for us to come together and to discuss the region, its prospects, and some of the enduring challenges that it faces and that U.S. policy tries to address. You know, with more than 20% of the world's population sitting astride these key global trade routes, South and Central Asia can and should be a key driver of the prosperity of the 21st century. It should be able to bring the sustainable security and economic development for billions of people across Asia, and ripple effects and ramifications for global security and prosperity. A more stable and prosperous South and Central Asia is directly in the U.S. interest and important to how we see the emerging prospects across Asia. An economically connected region will ensure that this stability and prosperity is more widely shared and endures for generations to come. And so the New Silk Road Initiative, which I know all of you are familiar with and all of you have differing interpretations of and interpret and views on, but fundamentally the New Silk Road Initiative is a reflection of the Obama administration's enduring commitment to this region and a recognition of the vital importance of the economic and energy connectivity and a representation of our belief that shared prosperity will enhance and lead to greater stability and security. So working side by side with the countries in the region, with bilateral donors, with international financial institutions, the United States has focused on a four-pronged strategy to bolster regional connectivity as a part of the New Silk Road. Specifically, we have focused on building regional energy markets, facilitating trade and transport, improving customs and border procedures, and linking businesses and people. The success of these efforts will be critical towards securing not only Afghanistan's economic, political, and security transition and its ties with its neighbors, but also in creating the important ties between Central Asia and South Asia. For too long, Central Asia's geography has defined its relationship with the rest of the world. But in the 21st century, economies can be powered by characteristics and qualities that are less beholden to the constraints of geography. And this region, which is mineral-rich, gas-rich, at a time when the markets of Asia have put enormous premium on predictable flow of resources to power these emerging markets. Central Asia is also vital in the support of the coalition efforts in Afghanistan over the past 14 years. And of course, our role in the region well predates the events of 9/11. In fact, many in this room will recall that, and a few have probably played a great role in bringing about, the early decision of the United States to recognize the independence of the Central Asian states some 25 years ago, and our enduring commitment to their sovereignty, their independence, and their territorial integrity. That commitment continues today in enhancing our bilateral ties from Ashgabat to Astana. But we understand the skepticism sometimes that we meet in the region and probably in this room when we speak of economic integration and regional connectivity and the pace of progress. Indeed, the region's political and ethnic diversity and dimensions make for complicated politics. But it also underscores a tremendous untapped potential and what some may perceive as economic isolation, others perceive as opportunities in the last true frontier for investment, innovation, and growth. So as we look beyond the region, clearly you can see in the world today a moment of rapid change where the tectonic plates of global politics and economics are shifting dramatically. And we're all very cognizant of the menace of violent extremism, as we've seen manifestations in Ottawa and Peshawar and Sydney and Paris, and the threat that we see to the well-being of societies and democracies across the globe. And yet, as we see also the concerns with slowing economic growth, many countries are starting to reassess their key relationships and seek greater diversification. We also see a move to reduce dependency in fossil fuels amongst many countries, as the impacts of pollution and climate change exact an increasing toll. We see a dynamic with the lower oil prices that have impacted negative consequences and challenges to those markets that are energy exporting, and positive benefits to those that have heavy dependencies on energy imports. And yet all of these developments, whether whether they occur in Tashkent or Tokyo, in Almaty or Ankara, are having a dramatic effect on this region as well. We've also seen some new political developments as new governments take effect in India and in Afghanistan and the opportunities that that has created. For instance, in India with Prime Minister Modi, we have seen a move towards implementing a long-delayed economic reform agenda and a renewed interest in reinvigorated ties to the region, a renewed focus on regional economic connectivity. And as we noted earlier, I'll be accompanying the president to India tomorrow, where he'll be the chief guest for India's Republic Day ceremony, marking the first time that the United States will have this honor and the first time that a sitting U.S. president will be twice visiting India during his tenure. A key focus of that visit will be the economic partnership and India's role in the region. And we know that the Modi government has put a premium on the markets of its neighbors, including its relationship with the Central Asian states, acknowledging that regional growth for too long has proven elusive and regional connectivity for the countries of South and Central Asia. It is clear that the populous markets of South Asia can offer an important opportunity for Central Asia, a predictable, vibrant market for the future in energy, in raw materials, in goods and services. And as we see here, Central Asia is one of the least integrated geographic regions in the world, with only about 6% of the total trade occurring within the region. Looking at the same measure of economic integration, 45% of the total trade among ASEAN plus Japan, Korea, and China is within the region. Meanwhile, India itself, as I noted, is rapidly taking steps to expand its trade with East and Southeast Asia. If you consider foreign direct investment flows, which may best reflect broader integration trends, FDI from Japan, Korea, and China to the rest of Asia, particularly ASEAN, has been steadily increasing. Conversely, intra-regional FDI flows into Central Asia are paltry at less than 1%. And as you can also see from the slide, the region lags in the World Bank's measurement of how much time it takes to export goods across national boundaries. This slide basically shows that Central Asia and Afghanistan are increasingly being left out of Asia's economic growth, weakening the region's resilience and making these countries more vulnerable to internal and external shocks. And there are probably a few reasons for this phenomenon. China and Russia currently dominate trade patterns that mostly transit east-west, and the trade to the rest of Asia through north-south routes is minimal, which means Central Asia and Afghanistan are largely cut off from the growth markets in the rest of South and Southeast Asia. But as Kazakhstan's foreign minister has said, Mr. Idrisov has said, that while Central Asia may be landlocked, there's no reason why it can't be land-linked, and that connectivity is what has driven that vision of the New Silk Road Initiative. In that vein, the U.S. strongly believes that with the right investments, Central Asian countries and Afghanistan can position themselves to share and indeed be a driver in Asia's rise. Expanding trade ties within the region, point south through Pakistan into India, can be a game changer. And by connecting to new markets, trade ties can boost political stability within the region and create additional incentives for countries to work together on shared challenges. President Ghani and his new government have recognized that sustaining gains made in Afghanistan over the past decade will require robust growth and more robust linkages with Afghanistan's neighbors. Indeed, President Ghani was just in Turkmenistan this week, working with President Berdimuhamedov to expand trade and transit of gas, electricity, and expanded rail connectivity. And this is the type of leadership that is going to be a key ingredient for any of this to work. But obviously, economic connectivity by itself is not enough to create an enduring peace or prosperity, and countries in the region need to strengthen transparent, accountable governance and adopt more environmentally sustainable growth policies, an initiative which President Nazarbayev has undertaken in his Green Economy Initiative, and to create inclusive political and economic systems that will provide more inclusive opportunity, particularly for women, for ethnic minorities. Let me state up front, we're not naive about these challenges. If this were easy, obviously it would have been done a long time ago. But we are bullish about the opportunities that lie ahead. A few specific examples that I want to highlight in some of the progress that's been made as I seek to conclude. A regional energy market, which is tremendously important to create the kind of diversity in energy flows, is beginning to take shape over the past year with the CASA 1000 electricity project, which will bring surplus summer hydropower from Central Asia to South Asia, as we have seen agreements now between the suppliers and between the consumers, and we have seen largely the financing come into place. We see prospects for that moving forward. And this is an important proof of concept project for the broader issue of regional connectivity. Now, we also see the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank working jointly together to ensure complementarity between the CASA project and the ADB's Two-Top project, which will also bring surplus electricity from Central Asia into Afghanistan via Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan. Uzbekistan is already providing electricity and lighting Kabul through Two-Top lines, and a major transmission line from Turkmenistan to Afghanistan is also in the works. We're also working closely with both the World Bank and the ADB to ensure that a fully integrated Central Asia-South Asia regional energy market can come into being in the future. This region would benefit from development of a Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India, or TAPI, pipeline, which would diversify flows of Turkmen natural gas to new markets in South Asia. Bringing TAPI to fruition will require the expertise of international oil companies, and we hope that we will see progress on this issue this year. We've certainly seen a degree of momentum and optimism being expressed by all of the TAPI countries, and we're ready to do our part to support that. Going forward, we will continue to work with Central Asian countries to address their domestic energy needs, particularly in the winter months when they often face the deficits. But we will also be supporting efforts within the region to address the transboundary water management issues, which are increasingly important and have serious ramifications on energy, on agriculture, and on environment. Turning to trade and transit issues, we see positive momentum towards breaking down barriers to trade. This is critical since a 10% reduction in transport costs increases trade by 25%. As landlocked countries have some of the highest transportation costs, creating corridors that reduce the cost of transport, maximize efficiency, and can evolve to include transport, trade, logistics, and even supply chain corridors. In Islamabad recently, Afghanistan and Pakistan met to review APTA, the historic Afghanistan-Pakistan Transit Trade Agreement. We were pleased to see Tajikistan join in these discussions for the first time, which we hope will provide additional momentum to support additional cross-border trade agreements in the region. And we are also seeing critical developments on rail connectivity. The rail line between Uzbekistan and Afghanistan, which the United States strongly supported, has played an important role in transporting goods in the region. With the right steps, even more can be achieved. Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan are also in discussions on a new rail line that can further connect these countries within the region and provide one day an outlet to the Caspian Sea. Now, let me just say a couple of words reflection on our very strong support for CARIC, or the Central, the ADB's Central Asia Regional Economic Cooperation Program. CARIC is developing 6 transport corridors linking Asia, Europe, and beyond through 7,800 kilometers of road, 3,800 kilometers of rail by 2020. These transport links will build upon the 3,000 kilometers of roads in Afghanistan and the 1,000 kilometers of road in Pakistan that the United States has built or improved over the past decade, including the 5 main trade routes into Afghanistan. And you can see the transportation corridors here that link the north-south into the east-west to create a more comprehensive transportation grid. However, as we turn these roads into highways of trade, we will need to have greater focus on customs and borders and harmonization. Bureaucratic, time-consuming, and expensive customs and border procedures are perhaps the biggest impediment to regional trade. And the United States is working with other donors on supporting more integrated border management and risk management systems. But again, the political will to combat corruption, tackle narcotic flows, and support greater trade across borders will be a real driver to unlock success. On the private sector side, thanks to partners at USAID, we have had tremendous success in sponsoring trade forums that in the past year alone have connected businesses across the region. More broadly, by supporting trade liberalization through the accession of the WTO into the WTO and regulatory reform, improving the investment climate, and promoting free market principles, many of which Mara worked on during her time at USTR, and I'm sure she'll address in her comments, we're seeking to help these economies become more attractive to investors and trading partners alike. And so as I conclude, let me just say, in the interest of full and more comprehensive picture, which is that there is a great deal of effort and investment by many other countries in this region. And as we look at the New Silk Road Initiative, and as Michael introduced in his intro, we're not obviously the only actors. And China, for example, is developing what they call the Silk Road Economic Belt, which we welcome and which is a very important investment as well. And we don't necessarily see these as being in competition, but in fact, complementarity. We, in fact, welcome China's very constructive engagement and see a great deal of potential as China creates the east-west links to be able to bring in the north-south links that come in. But we would urge that as China pursues its economic cooperation projects, that it utilize global standards and best practices in order to ensure sustainable economic growth and inclusive growth for all of the people of Central Asia as well as the Chinese people. As we look at the important economic relationships with Russia, which has deep historic political and economic ties to the region, Russia will also continue to be a major economic force in the region. But at the same time, we fundamentally believe that Central Asian states need the space to make their own decisions on how to further their economic development, preserve their political autonomy, and deepen their integration with global markets. The expansion of the Eurasian Economic Union, for example, should not come at the expense of member countries fulfilling their existing international commitments, including their commitments to the World Trade Organization. Nor should it restrict their ability to enter into other bilateral or multilateral trade relationships. So we see a picture that is complex and evolving, but vitally important for us to be engaged in and to be able to shape and to be able to advance. And so I look forward to hearing your questions, but also look forward to the comments of my colleagues on the panel as we further continue this discussion on both the challenges and the opportunities presented in regional economic integration and the New Silk Road Initiative. I really want to, again, thank you for your patience, for your attention, and for your forbearance for my delays in getting here. Thank you so much.